Good morning. Good to see everybody. We have visitors in the audience. Thank you for coming here and being with us this morning. Can you imagine being given a map of Dallas-Fort Worth, Texas, or Little Rock, Arkansas, and then discover, but you pretend with me that you've never been to either one of those places, and that the one printing the map had given you a map of L.A., of Los Angeles. So maybe Dallas-Fort Worth would be more fitting for size-wise. And you have no idea. It's labeled, it's Los Angeles, but it's labeled Dallas-Fort Worth. And so you try to find your way around. You try to, folks, you've got to go back with me. I'm old. We use maps. And I still take a big map with me. And I look at where I'm going. I don't trust GPS. Sometimes it takes you through the barnyard and through the back roads to get you somewhere. It'll get you there, but it's hilarious sometimes what happens if you don't know. And I always look at a big map. I want to know where I'm going. How do I get from point A to point B? Everybody in this room is on a journey from point A to point B. You may not want to think about it. Nobody likes to talk about death. Nobody likes to talk about even why we're here. We just sort of like to go through the experience, you know. Have fun playing video games. Have fun going camping. Have fun going to basketball games, baseball games this time of year. Whatever it is that you enjoy doing in life and spending your money on, and just think that sort of in this sphere, that's what sums up our existence. But somewhere along the way, we have to think about it. Foxholes and hospitals have helped people think a lot about eternity. It's forced it. It's made people realize their mortality. And the problem is none of us want to think about mortality. When you're 20 years old, you think you're long, long way from dying. And yet you know every year there are people that are 20 years old die. They die from diseases. They die from car wrecks. You get to be my age and you realize, yeah, it's more likely. And if you go out and buy life insurance now, you're going to pay a whopping amount because they also know that you don't have that much time left. Point A to point B, if I have a map that says Dallas-Fort Worth and it's Los Angeles, and somebody says, well, just try harder, you know, or get a positive mental help books in the help section, that'll get you through it. If you don't have the right map, if you don't have the correct way to guide you from point A to point B, that's everybody in this world for the most part. That people are trying to get around and maneuver in life and they have no idea where they're going. They don't know how to get from point A to point B. That's what the Ten Commandments are all about. They're all about getting from point A to point B. It's amazing how fundamental they are. That codes of law in nations, including our own, have been based upon the Ten Commandments. Now, God takes sort of that secondary role, but nonetheless, His words, the names God appear in our documents, our founding documents. There still is, if you go back to a realization of our founders, what they thought of and how they thought. God was all in everything, no matter what the history people are trying to teach you now. The first of the Ten Commandments, you shall have no other gods before me. It is all about putting first things first, of reversing priorities, of understanding which of the ten comes first. A university professor gave out copies of the Ten Commandments. Imagine, you know this, and I do, if you watch Jeopardy. If there is a column on the Bible in Jeopardy, does it go first or last? I mean, I always get tickled about that. People know all this other trivia. They know so much stuff about junk in this world. But if it says anything about the Bible, it's the last column. Any one of those players, there's three of them, are going to tackle. Because that's our world. They don't think about the Bible. It has no meaning to them. University professor hands out a copy in a secular classroom of the Ten Commandments, doesn't tell them anything about it. They know so little about the Bible, they don't even recognize it as the Ten Commandments. And his simple question was this. Rank these in order. From most important, what's first on the list, to bottom. What do you think they did with that? The list is divided equally between the four and the six. The four that relate to God that we are about to look at, the very first one that relates to Him, and then the six that rank man and man. Thou shalt not murder. Thou shalt not commit adultery. Thou shalt not steal. Thou shalt not covet. And that classroom of secular people, not even realizing they were dealing, I'm not saying every last one didn't know it was the Ten Commandments, but understanding that most people don't have a concept of the Bible at all, they rank the bottom six as being the most important, and they rank them in the order of what they thought, like thou shalt not murder as being number one. That's the problem with our world. If we don't get it right, then we're going to be in the mess that we see. All in our world, all in churches too at times. The first and most important section is the way God puts it. And the very first one is the most important of all. You shall have no other gods before me. Jesus deals with that. In Mark 12:28, he said, then one of the scribes came, and having heard them reasoning together, perceiving that he had answered them well, asked him, which is the first commandment of all? So thinking of all the Old Testament law of Moses. Jesus answered him, the first of all the commandments is, hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, with all your strength. This is the first commandment. To get that right will help you from point A to point B, get everything else right. Get this wrong, and everything goes haywire. Ed Harrell, and many of you that are my age knew him when he was alive. He was a professor. In fact, he was a professor here at the University of Arkansas for a time. I think they were members at Old Wire Road, and some of you, I'm sure, knew them and knew them well. He eventually ended up down in Alabama and he finished out his career there. But he was well known in Southern religions that related to Christianity. He was the expert. I can still remember Good Morning America one morning waking up, and there was some huge thing that happened, one of the televangelists, I can't remember. And all of a sudden, Ed Harrell appears on my TV screen. I've heard Ed Harrell preach, you know. He just had that way of slapping his hands together. You could never think when you saw one time he came to a gospel meeting and he had his golf bags, and the preacher looked at him and said, Ed, where's your suits? He said, they're in the golf bag. He just rolled them up and stuck them in there, and they look like it too. You ever watched? I mean, he didn't care about stuff like that. And he could preach. And his fellow professor, I mean, here you're talking about a guy who they endowed a $1 million chair at the time. Arkansas did the same thing, and the University ended up, Alabama did the same thing. I mean, he was at the top of his game, so he was respected in his peers, and they knew he preached, and they thought that was really quaint. A professor of history preaching. So one of his friends asked him one day, said, well, what is it that you preach? What do you believe? And he talked about the resurrection of Jesus Christ. He talked about the most fundamental things of sin and obeying God, and that God is real and He exists. And as he listened to him, finally that professor looked at him and said, oh, those peripheral issues. Because he said, what does your church teach about global warming and nuclear disarmament? That's what the world thinks. That's what they think is important. And God could care less. I'm not saying He didn't care about the moral principles that relate to some of those things. I'm saying that's not first. First is, you shall have no other gods before me. That's not a peripheral issue. It is center and core to everything that we do. If I say to our young people, And you do, as you teach them in your homes and other places, what reasons do we give them for not engaging in sexual immorality? What kind of things do we say? My first reaction is, if my son confessed to me that he had committed sexual immorality with a girl, what's my first reaction going to be? What's yours as a parent? Is she pregnant? That's almost the first thing I'm going to think of. And then we're going to talk about unwanted pregnancy. I mean, this is a consequence. You see this happen in families. You see marriages get started for the wrong reason and then bust up because they are not started on the basis they ought to. You know what my second reason is? Probably close to the first one is my reputation. Am I going to have to quit as a preacher and step down as a shepherd and everything else because of this? And then so we preach that to our kids, don't we? Your reputation is built inches by inches and is destroyed in a second. And the thing happens to many people. Thirdly, I may think of disease or death. You could get AIDS. You know what I didn't think about at all? What does God think? Where is God in that process of saying to our kids, don't commit sexual immorality? If you get this one right, you don't have to deal with Aphrodite. Have no other gods before me. Aphrodite was the god of sex, a god of, I mean, call her whatever you want to. In the Canaanite culture, they had the same thing under a different name. In our culture, it's just sex. But it's the same god or goddess. It always has been. Call it Bacchus or alcohol. Call it Mars or war and hatred and taking whatever you want. Have no other gods before me. It's going to clear up a lot of things, right? If I have that right, it doesn't mean that I won't make the mistake as a young person and I may commit sexual immorality, but I'm going to back up. I may have fallen into that trap once. I'm not going to keep falling into it if God is first in my heart. What is built into this command is the understanding of man's built-in need for God. Notice what it doesn't say. It doesn't say, the very first command doesn't say, believe in God. The Bible assumes God. It says, have no other gods before me. We need to understand that. Foxholes and hospitals, I've said, have been proving for years that people instantly in those situations know they have a need for God. How many times I've been to the hospital to visit somebody and sometimes I mean, verbatim they say, preacher, I know I haven't been living right. I know that I've not been doing what I ought to do, but when I get out of here, you're going to see a different me. You know how often that happens? About zero. And as soon as their health is restored and everything is okay, then they go back to living the way they did before. But the ones that really think, the ones that are thinking before that, everyone has a God. We either are serving the real, true, and living God or we're serving some false version. You cannot serve God in mammon, Jesus said. Some people's God is money and all that it buys. Galatians 3 verse 5, covetousness, put it away from you, put it to death. Covetousness, which is idolatry, he says. You are the one slaves whom you obey, Romans 6, 16, whether sin to death or obedience to righteousness, everyone has God or gods. The first sin is to put other gods before him. If we get the first one right, then we interpret all the ones that deal with horizontal things in light of that. Why no murder? Because I strike at someone made in the image of God. If I love my brother as myself, the second of the great, the first is God, the second is love your neighbor as yourself. It's based upon the first. If I understand they're made in the image of God, then I'm not going to hate them. That drives me to the point that I would murder somebody because I strike at the very image of God. Why no adultery? Not because God is anti-sex. He gave us the place in marriage to have the peaceful, harmonious, fulfilling place of what He made. But why no adultery? Because it hurts other people. Because again, it strikes at the throne of God, the very fabric of society. Why not steal and covet for the same reason? We are not thinking about them being made in the image of God. God is not first in our life. And therefore, why should we not be surprised at the mess that our current world is in? And will always be in when God is not first. Several years ago, my wife and I made a trip to see a brother in Norway that we had converted when he had come over as an exchange student in high school, and we had converted him. We hadn't seen him for many years. I think at that time it was 18 or so years. He was up in his 30s now and had married a lady from Japan, and so we went to Norway to see him. But on our way there, or back, I can't remember, we went through London, and I went to Westminster Abbey, and I looked at that really kind of old wooden throne that Queen Elizabeth was crowned on. Something now like more than half a century. She's already celebrated that. I forget how many more years added to that. But here's what I knew about that plain wooden throne, is that William the Conqueror had been crowned on it. And every king and queen since. Now you're going back a millennium. It's sitting there. And what I also noticed was this. It wasn't a throne pew. Only one person could sit in that chair. Only one. It wasn't a throne for several. It was a throne for one. God is king. And that's what this first passage is telling us. And before he can tell us, here's what I want. Fundamentally, don't steal, don't covet, don't murder, don't hate, all the things that are behind it. He says, here's who I am. And once we get that right, we'll get the rest of it right. So if we know who is king, we know that he is king, then here are some things that he said. And this is the first lesson that I preached to you. So we just go through it quickly. Number one, I am the unchanging God. He begins by saying, I am the Lord your God. All capitals there, by the way, is the name Yahweh. If you have Lord with small caps, that is Adonai. And that can be said to a king of the earth. You can say, my Lord, the king. You're not calling him Yahweh. But if it's all caps in the King James, Old King James, English Standard, then you're dealing with the covenant name of God. And by the way, the name Jehovah or Yahweh means I am. The high priest had it on it's called the Tetragrammaton. We don't know what vowels went with it, but four consonants. He wore it on a brass plate on his turban. As he entered the presence of God, the name was written. As he entered the very place, he remembered what Moses heard God speak from that burning bush. When he asked him who he is, he said, I am who I am. Boy, that tells me a lot. It tells me a lot, but there have been reams written on that. Go do your own research. Look at commentaries. And they'll go everywhere. And it's all good stuff because all of it's relevant. Take the idea of eternity. Nobody in this room can say, I am. What you're going to say about me before too long is Chuck was. And it is just a blip of time. We're nothing. Only God can say, I am. For he never changes. He is the same God that spoke to Noah and Adam, that spoke to Abraham thousands of years later, that spoke to David thousands more years later, that spoke to through Jesus to all the disciples in the first century, to you and to me today. He is the God that alone can be, I am. Times have changed, but God doesn't. He deserves first place in our hearts because if he doesn't change, his values are always relevant. Why is it wrong to lie, to commit adultery, to steal? Why? The U.S. Supreme Court, several years ago, Remember what I said to you last week. Don't put your trust in men. I'm grateful that Roe v. Wade has been struck down. But folks, just get the right desk on the Supreme Court and the wrong guy in the presidency, and we're right back to where they'll overthrow it. I mean, they'll instate it again. Don't put your trust in men. The U.S. Supreme Court's definition of obscenity. Obscene was defined, they said, by the community. Washington County, Arkansas, does not have the same standard of obscenity, at least yet, that is standard fare in New York City or some other major urban center. If we define obscenity, as the Supreme Court said, by the local community, then eventually you'll allow movie and artwork and literature to deteriorate to where what you would not have allowed 20 and 30 and 40 and 50 years ago becomes standard fare. Who's changed? The material or the people? And the sad reality is it's the people, because we've not gone to the eternal source, the unchanging God and His morals. Having been born again, Peter said, not of corruptible seed, but incorruptible through the Word of God that lives and abides forever. All flesh is grass, and all the glory of man is the flower of grass. The grass withers and the flower falls away, but the Word of the Lord endures forever. And this is a word by the gospel that was preached to you. Secondly, he says, I am the Lord your God, your God. Here's what's fascinating about the word "your." He's speaking to all of Israel from Mount Sinai. He's giving the Ten Commandments to the nation. But the word "you" here is not plural. Now, you and I understand that we have to sort of define it with English. I can say "you" when I look out here and I'm looking at Calvin and I'm thinking, "you, Calvin." But most of the time, if you hear me say "you" from up here, you're thinking I mean plural. The Greek language, the Hebrew language, very specific. You know if he means singular because there was a different ending on the verb. The same is true in Hebrew. What is the "you" here is singular, not plural. That means something. I am the Lord your God, Ross. I am the Lord your God, Clayton. I am the Lord your God, Taryn. I am the Lord your God, Chuck. I read passages like Mark 12:6. It says, when he spoke from the burning bush, God said, I am the God of Abraham. I am the God of Isaac. I am the God of Jacob. That means something. Because what it's saying is God wants to have a relationship with you, Taryn, with you, Clayton, with you, Ross, with me, Chuck, and you too, Calvin. He wants to have a relationship with you. George Washington is the father of our country. That says a lot. He did amazing things to bring about what we have in our government, in our values. But you know what? I don't relate to him the way I relate to my dad, who gave me time and nurture and care and devotion and love. And as I grew older, I came to respect him in a way that I would not want to hurt him by ever doing things that would bring shame on him because of all that he had done for me, the relationship he had built with me. That's what God is saying. He cares about us. Daniel, when Daniel prayed to God in Daniel 9, the angel that came down said to him, "You are greatly beloved, Daniel." You think God looks down on you and says that? You are beloved. You are my special person. Remember that. And then it says, He is the redeeming God. I brought you out of Egypt. And again, think of the power it took to do that. Think of the mighty army He had to defeat. Redeeming always has the idea of delivering. And you and I come to understand that, even in the Old Testament, they did, from sin. And the greatest evil that we all face, God delivers us from the mighty power of Egypt, of sin. All right, that was the first lesson that we learned, knowing who our King is. Now we'll close with these points. How do we keep God first? Every day I'm going to have to focus on Him. Do you think of God, are my decisions made in light of His approval? What do I think about when I'm going to take a job somewhere? Do I think, is there a good church there? Am I going to be able to go? Maybe I'll have time to help plan a church, but a lot of times that's not going to be the case if I'm moving up in a company and you think about what's going to happen to your family. Do I think about God in all my decisions? When you're in the shower, what do you think about? If you're my age, you think about slipping and falling. You know, you make sure you drop soap in the shower and you go, that is a long way down there. You know, young guys, Ty, you get in the shower and you sing. You know, young guys sing. And I'm going to tell you something I do in the shower. I think. You think about God? You mowing your yard, do you think about God? When you're riding your bike, when you're jogging, when you're commuting to work, do you think about God? Because that's what focus means. We focus our attention and our life upon Him. In His law, He meditates day and night. Oh, how I love Your law. It is my meditation all the day. Secondly, what about our giving? Is God who we value most? You know, our pay stubs, our checking account won't lie. Sometimes take your checking account, just look through it. And ask yourself, as you spend the amounts that you put in a column, look at what you give God. Remember that when you give to God, you're doing something that goes back as old as Jacob and Abraham. Have you ever thought about where did they get this concept? When Abraham had gone and destroyed those kings that had taken Lot, came back and Melchizedek, who was both king and priest of God Most High. That is just fascinating to me. In that terrible, wicked country of the Canaanites, there was this priest in Jerusalem, what we would know as Jerusalem eventually, who was called priest of God Most High. And he was greater than Abraham. That's the argument of the Hebrew author that says Levi, being in the loins of his father Abraham, paid tithes to Melchizedek. Abraham gave him a tenth of all that he had. Where did they get that idea? Where did that come from? This is long before the law of Moses. Long before the law of Moses. When Jacob pillows his head at that place that will be called Bethel, the house of God. It was called Luz by the Canaanites, but it would be called Bethel or Bethel as we understand it. Bethel. And he saw that staircase of the angels coming and going from earth to heaven and God at the top. He vowed to God that if you will take me to the land, remember he's going, he's been sent away to find a wife and bring him back, and it's going to be 20 years. What does he say? You'll be my God and I'll be your servant. I will give you a tenth of everything I have. Where did he get that idea? And here's something. Ask yourself this. There's no temple then. Who did they give it to? Who did he give that tenth to? Abraham gave a tenth to Melchizedek. Maybe there were situations like that that just abound and we don't know anything about it. Just get glimpses at times. But here's what I do know. They gave a tenth long before the law of Moses of everything they had. To Yahweh. What are you giving to Yahweh? What am I? I'll tell you, it's taken me a long time to get close to a tenth. I haven't done that. I'll just be frank with you. I look at my percentage. It didn't get anywhere near 10%. I'm not trying to tell you that's what the Bible says. You got to do this. But I'm telling you, why is it telling us these things? If it's not saying, you better pay attention. If these men were saying this a long time ago, something's there. We better pay attention. Is he who we value most? Do we value others? Do I see them in God's image? Jonathan will tell you that as he drives with me, I talk to the traffic if they do dumb stuff. And sometimes I wonder if God will not bring that to my mind when judgment day comes. Do you care about their soul? Or that they did dumb stuff in traffic? We get really peeved about stuff, don't we? And with people. I saw it the other day and put it on Facebook. Some of you may saw it. It was a little phrase that said, I want to follow Jesus and slap people too. That's my problem. But do I look at others first as souls made in the image of Almighty God? He made them. He ensouled them. And He wants them. Do I want them as badly as He does? Security. Do we turn to God first? Or in our worry, do we turn, as that king in the Old Testament, when he was diseased and his feet turned first to the physicians and did not turn to God? And finally, time. Do we give God more than Sunday? Mark 1:35, and in the morning it says of Jesus, having risen a long while before daylight, he went out and departed to a solitary place, and there he prayed. You ever done that? In Daniel 6 and verse 10, Daniel knew the writing was signed. He went home in his upper room with his windows open toward Jerusalem. He knelt down on his knees 3 times that day and prayed again thanks for his God, as was his custom since early days. Do you have deliberate prayer life that 3 times a day you go to where you pray? In Colossians 1 and verse 18, the text says of Jesus, He is the firstborn Son who was raised from death in order that He alone might have the first place in all things. God must be first. And Jesus, His Son, now, as He reigns upon the throne, He will hand it back to God the Father at the end of all things. Before the days of modern navigational aid, ships crossing the Atlantic Ocean used 2 separate compasses. One was fixed to the deck where the steersman could see it and try to keep the ship on course. The other compass was fastened at the top of one of the masts in the days of sailing masts. And often a sailor would climb up to check and to be certain they were still on course. So a voyager with the ship's captain asked, why are there 2 compasses? The captain replied, this is an iron vessel. And the compass on the deck is often affected by its surroundings. But that's not the case with the compass at the top of the mast. That one is above the influence of what's around it. We steer by that compass because it is more reliable. Ultimately, how do you get from point A to point B? You're subject to heaven's invitation this morning. Jesus said, he that believes and is baptized shall be saved. He that believes not shall be condemned. If we can help you this morning to get from point A to point B, begin that journey. As our brother talked about in the Lord's Supper, has been talked about in Peter already in the class. While we stand, while we sing.